Let's be real. Life happens. Kids spill. Pets shed. And accidents are inevitable. Find a sofa that can keep up at washablesofas.com. Starting at just $699, our sofas are fully machine washable inside and out. So you can say goodbye to stains and hello to worry-free living. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics. They're kid-proof, pet-friendly, and built for everyday life. Plus, changeable fabric covers let you refresh your sofa whenever you want. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa anytime to fit your space, whether it's a growing family room or a cozy apartment. Plus, they're earth-friendly and trusted by over 200,000 happy customers. It's time to upgrade to a stress-free, mess-proof sofa. Visit washablesofas.com today and save. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim has the week off. He is recovering, taking care of his foot, which is healing nicely. We thank so much, all of our massive audience, for sending out your prayers, thoughts, and healing for Tim. It is certainly appreciated and definitely needed. So keep pouring it on. Tim will be back with us next week to reinvest himself back in the show once his health is up and he's able to be a little bit more maneuverable. But right now he needs to take all the weight off his feet and just take care of himself. So we're going to be flying solo this week. You just get me for this week, and we're going to have fun again next week with Tim again. But we've got some great topics lined up for you. As a matter of fact, tonight we're going to talk about sorcery and forbidden knowledge. Tomorrow we're going to talk about a very strange alien abduction case of a twin. And then later on in the week, I know this is going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. We're going to talk about possessed possessions, haunted toys. We'll do that here on Beyond the Darkness. Let's get started with tonight's topic, though. Our guest is joining us. He's been with us before on Darkness Radio. He's back now on Beyond the Darkness. Dr. Mark Mirabello will be our guest. He's the author and a professor of history at Shawnee State University here in the United States, and has served as a visiting professor of history at a university in Russia. I'm not even going to try to say the name of this because I know I'll butcher it. Mr. Mirabello has appeared on the History Channel discussing deadly cults in the series called Ancient Aliens, and he has appeared with Professor Noam Chomsky in M.A. Littler's maverick film on the freedom, The Kingdom of Survival, the latter shown on screens in the USA, Canada, Germany, Ireland, Mexico, the Netherlands, Germany, and North Africa, and was also broadcast on the FSTV network in America. He has been featured on several radio programs. As I mentioned, he's been on with us before on Darkness Radio and also with our good friend George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM. So if you love what you hear on Darkness Radio for the best in paranormal talk radio, make sure you keep tuned in for the best in overnight talk radio with George Norrie Monday through Friday. You can find more information about that at coasttocoastam.com, and I'll be hosting it again this Saturday night. So make sure you mark that on your calendars and check it out. You can find times, listings, and stations in your area by visiting coasttocoastam.com. Joining us back on the show right now, Dr. Mark Mirabello. Dr. Mirabello, thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me back again. It's a pleasure.
It's great to talk with you. Let's, for people that are new and not real familiar with your story, let's reintroduce you for our audience. Tell me a little bit about you and what got you into researching this type of topic, sorcery, forbidden knowledge, magic, all of that.
Strangely enough, it happened at the end of my graduate work when I talk about my cold. I'll be doing that throughout the program, sorry. when I was a graduate student at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, I was basically studying Orthodox standard history. But near the end, I was every week I was going to Edinburgh to use a bookstore and use the research there in the National Library. I encountered at what used to be called James Thynne's Books. It was an 18th century bookstore, this old arcane collection of magical texts, texts on superstition, werewolves, vampires, so on and so forth. And it drew my interest into the unusual. I've always been interested in beliefs more than facts. Now, I'm not trying to say, like when we discuss magic tonight, that none of this is real. What I try to discuss in my classes, at least, is say I like to discuss the traditions and lore and let the people decide, is this real or is this not real? Of course, science dismisses all this as simply claptrap, but I think there might be something to it. And we've become detached from old beliefs that have really ancient prehistorical roots.
All right. With that said, you've done a lot of research and a lot of traveling. Have you ever seen something done that you would put in the category of real magic? Not in the sense of illusion and sleight of hand, but something that would be conjured, something that would be from another realm. Not, as I said, not like a stage show magician, but something otherworldly.
Curiously enough, the short answer is no, and I'll give you the specific reason why. There was an interesting Renaissance writer named Johann of Heidelberg, and he mentions in his writing, 16th century, that the knowledge of magic, sorcery, paranormal, and so forth is not dangerous, but the practice thereof is. And again, when I'd like to sort of mention tonight, if people become interested in these things, they really shouldn't practice them. It's similar to if you have an electrical problem in your house. You shouldn't be playing with the wires unless you have training in electrical work. And frankly, magical operations are not for fun. They can be very dangerous. In fact, especially since the 1980s, New Age movement, it's turned magical operations into almost something teenage girls can play in their bedrooms to get their boyfriends back. It's actually very dangerous if it's true. There's a power to it. In fact, magic is all about power. And one of the points I did want to make very clear is modern people today, they think of magic as simply paranormal activities. For example, if I sit at one end of a room and cause somebody to move across the room with my thoughts only, they'll say that's a magical operation. But if I use some kind of tool to cause something to happen, that's not. Well, originally, there's no distinction. Renaissance writers refer to what we would call science as natural magic. So, for example, if you have an herb that reduces pain, a better example would be willow bark, is actually the source of modern aspirin. We view this as non-magical. This is scientific. Willow bark, now synthesized into aspirin, is simply a biochemical reaction to reduce pain. That's not how traditional peoples view it. You may use material things to cause things to happen. And it's all about power, making things happen. And in fact, that's the big distinction between the magician and the priest. The priest is, for example, essentially begging a god to accomplish something for the priest. In fact, our word prayer in English is derived from the Anglo-Saxon word to beg. In contrast, the magician is actually ordering gods to do things. In fact, in many of these traditions, including even, for example, in the Vedas and various traditions of Hinduism, the Brahmin priest, who actually also is a scholar, a sage, and in a sense a magician, he can control the gods and the universe itself. So this is why magicians, real magicians, always take they have protective measures. For example, the magic circle. And that's an elaborate procedure because typically if you summon an entity, the first thing it does is attack you. There's an interesting work from 18th century Germany. Was printed in the early 18th century and describes a magical operation. And it's all given as true. Two young men, apparently in a cellar in a small town in Germany, 18th century, tried to summon an entity The one person was found covered in basically lacerations. His flesh was torn, and he was insane. The other one was found outside the magical circle they had done incorrectly, and not only was he shredded, his trousers, not to be grotesque on you, was filled with feces, his own feces, from total fear. So these, again, are prohibited and dangerous operations. So, frankly, if I had the opportunity to witness a magical operation, for example, you can see them in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, it'd be not advised to go. These are people playing with powerful forces. So, again, your short answer, I've never seen one, but I'm more interested in the lore and the techniques as opposed to the practice.
But given the opportunity to go and witness and see something like this for yourself, are you saying that you would most likely beg off and hear about the story afterward rather than actively participate or witness an activity like this?
What I know, actually, yes, because I would avoid it, because it would be similar to not wanting to be a witness at the first atomic bomb detonation. It would be, even though people found that wonderful and interesting and was an achievement of science, it was very dangerous, and perhaps some of these people had their lifetime shortened because of the radiation. And in real procedures, in fact, I should maybe give a few examples. There's not really, I use the term sorcery, for example, we're talking tonight. There really isn't that distinction. I just typically do that, for example, classes to get student attention. And magic and sorcery are all the same, and they're neither good nor evil. It's how they're used. Again, you can use that metaphor with electricity again. You can use it to bring light into a room. You can also use it to power an electric chair to kill somebody in a horrible way. And in the case of, I'll give an example of voodoo again, they have the white sect and the red sect. Now, the white sect, this is what people would normally view if they were to go to Port-au-Prince and witness what they think are typical magical operations. You would see people at a kind of makeshift, I shouldn't call it makeshift, but a kind of self-constructed temple. And it's typically in a house or it's in a backyard. And everybody's dressed in white. And there's rhythmic drumming. And they're clapping. And they're dancing in a clockwise direction. And if you were to witness one of these ceremonies, they're calling upon some of the more benign loa, they're called. These are godlike beings. And it's going to be for something small. For example, a job promotion, perhaps again to use the teenage girl example, to win a teenage boy's love. And you would make an offering to the priest or priestess. They would summon the loa and try to get help from the loa. Now, in a more dangerous operation, incidentally, all of these pre-Christian entities, they don't have really demons in these traditions. But every god has a dangerous side. And some of the more, the older loa are especially powerful, and they would be summoned only as an act of desperation. For example, if some really wealthy man, his empire is going to collapse, or perhaps you're Bernie Madoff and the police are on your trail before you're going to get caught, you would summon out of supreme desperation what is called the Red Sect. Now, if you would go to Port-au-Prince, they would deny this even exists because they're afraid of these sorcerers. Anyone who practices Red Sect voodoo, he has to offer a relative, according to the reports, for a killing, a sacrifice. He has to drink human blood. He has to go through a ritual that lasts approximately 2 weeks where he is in total isolation. He dresses in white, which, by the way, in voodoo symbolizes death. And also, he may only eat white food, which also in voodoo symbolizes death. White food would be such things as rice and milk. And then at a red sect operation, all the dancing is in counterclockwise direction. It's very frenzied. The drumming is syncopated. It's offbeat, which is really curious because syncopated drumming appears in modern rock and roll and so forth. And when 1950s people, families, they used to have those old videos where they would denounce rock and roll as devil's music, because they were informed. They knew what this meant in old traditions of summoning these ancient entities. And then you would offer some kind of sacrifice. You always do this during a ritual. Blood draws the spirits. If you're doing this in a white sect, it's basically simply maybe some chicken. If in red sect, it can be even what's called the goat without horns, which according to reports would be a child sacrifice. And the higher the offering, in terms of being closer to humans or a human offering, you would release more power. And if you were to show up at a red sect ritual, you could end up as the sacrifice. If you weren't really informed of what's going on,
right.
It's closed. And frankly, I think there's something to it. The human race has spent, I often like to say, over 99.9% of its existence in a sort of prehistorical mode with these ancient traditional gods and traditions and spirits and loa and so forth. And there's probably powers we no longer understand. And they can make things happen. There's a great line when the British encountered the Aboriginal people of Australia. The old men told the British, who had technology, one time long ago, we could do everything you do with your machines. You can send messages with telegraphs. You can sail across the sea great distances. Long ago, during the dream time, we could do this with our magical power. And they say they had lost it. And it'd be really ironic that what we think we're now achieving with technology, with the internet and space program and so forth, perhaps humans once were able to do that without technology. These are the traditions of magic, that remote viewing, that a shaman from Paleolithic times could see the surface of the moon.
Well, do you think, can I ask you, Dr. Mirabella, do you think that what might have occurred is that this magical realm existed, that these abilities did possibly exist and were accessible to people? But what happened was the more that it was used, the more that people became conscious and aware of it. Do you believe that it may have, you know, awakened the rest of us to the ideas of creating technological advancements in order to make it accessible for everyone? And that once we did that, once we tapped that keg of knowledge, did that then, like, you know, the need for a tail, you know, humans no longer have a need for it. So that part of our biology has faded and gills or whatever else we may have once had has faded away because we have now evolved to a point where that is no longer needed because we can do it in other ways.
That's very possible. Although in most of the traditions, they seem to say that what has happened is we've declined. They always view this as decline,
mm-hmm.
that at one time the gods walked among us. And they've now departed. We've become corrupt. We've become inferior, if you will. What's really curious is the post-Darwin period, we always view ourselves as the pinnacle of all things. Humans have never been this civilized, have never been this intelligent, have never been this powerful.
Right.
But in most traditional approaches, we are in full-scale decline. And it's beginning worse and worse and worse. And it's simply just like a person who's disabled needs a cane to walk, we need the machines that once we could use our minds and our wills. And by the way, I should also mention that with magical operations, science exercises its power directly on the outside world. It cuts down trees. It knocks down mountains. It does this sort of activity. But in magic, the magician focuses the power inward, and by doing something to himself, alters the outside world, which, of course, that's an old idea, again, universal, the microcosm, macrocosm, that the universe and the human are actually the same, if you will, that the universe is simply a large human, and a human is simply a small universe. And incidentally, when I keep referring to traditional cultures, all these notions of magic are found, for example, in the early ancient civilizations, such as the Egyptian. And in fact, when we were talking earlier program about my research in afterlife concepts among the Egyptians, they have salvation through magic, if you will, how to stay alive after death using magical operations. They believe that magic was the sort of universal power. And by the way, we don't recognize it, but it's, for example, implicit in the Bible. And if you open up Genesis, in the beginning, God said, "Let there be light." Well, that's as magical as it gets.
Right.
Because in magic, the spoken word has creative force, and the God is thinking, and then speaking, and things are coming into being. And by the way, also, if you look at the Old Testament, even today, pious Jews don't know the name of God. Scholars will say it's Yahweh. Jehovah's Witnesses will say it's Jehovah, but we don't know what it was because they were never allowed to pronounce it. And ancient Hebrew does not insert vowels into the writing, so we've lost the true pronunciation of the name of God. And by the way, it's believed that if you properly pronounce, according to this is Jewish lore, the name of God correctly, and you're not magically prepared, if you will, or purified, you will turn into a heap of black ashes. And that's why the name of God is hidden. Now also, you'll see in the Bible, Second Commandment, thou shalt not make a graven image of God. Well, where's that coming from? Modern people just simply, well, they were opposed to the pagans making idols. And the Jews understood that their gods were not coexistent with these statues. Well, that's not what's going on at all. That's one of the principles of magic. In fact, there's two important ones: imitative magic and contagious magic. Now, imitative magic is found all across the globe. And if some two things resemble one another in likeness, form, color, whatever, they're magically connected. So it's believed that if you make an image of, that's what's in Jewish law, if you make an image of God, you make his statue, you then act on the statue, you can act on the deity. Now, traditional religions did that. That's why the Egyptians,
now, when you say act on, does that mean that when you craft a statue of the god, you're basically like the golem, right? The clay character. You create this thing and empower it, and therefore you control it?
Yes. In fact, if you were to make a statue of, according to magical thought, Jehovah, and then stab it, you would be stabbing God. That's the principle in the voodoo doll, which everyone's familiar with. The original voodoo doll is made out of typically feathers. It is then tied together with cords, and the sorcerer who wants to hurt somebody, in this case, he slowly takes out the cords until this is over a period of days and weeks, until the feathered doll falls to pieces, and when it eventually falls to pieces, the victim dies. Now, you can also do this imitative magic, it's called, in reverse. For example, that's why Egyptians would fill the tombs of the dead pharaohs with statues of the pharaoh. Because if his image still exists, and you preserve it, and you do things and positive things towards it, you actually help out the deceased. And if you do this for gods, that's why the Egyptians every day would take out the idols of the gods, bathe them, dress them. You do this to the original. Now, they never thought that the god itself is in the image directly. That's a kind of monotheistic fiction. But they thought that by acting on the image, you could act on the original. Now, the second principle of magic is called contagious magic. When things are connected over a long period of time, they remain connected. That's why traditional peoples are very afraid of discarding their nail clippings, hair clippings, clothing they wear over a great period of time, because someone can act on this with sorcery. In fact, the best made voodoo doll would not only be your image, the sorcerer would also steal something from you, such as hair clippings, article of clothing, and he would put this in the doll. And what's really curious is these ideas are around the globe. I mean, it's not just in Egypt, it's not just in Africa, it's not just in South America, it's in Europe. And 19th century anthropologists, who I always thought they were much better than the ones today, they were quite stunned by this. Like, why are these ideas appearing all over the place? And, of course, the two rationalizations they came up with, one was diffusion, that they date back to the dawn of humanity, and the idea just spread as the human race spread. And the other one was somehow, because they were influenced by Darwin, that cultures go through evolutionary steps. And when they're at a certain level, they think a certain way. And they used to dismiss magical thinking as childlike thinking. For example, they would point out that children do a lot of things that magical people do. The little girl and now little boys with their action figures play with the dolls, and they think when the little girl dresses up the doll, she's doing something nice to the doll, and there's something going on magically. And 19th century fellows would point out and say, look how stupid primitive people are. They're acting like little girls with their dolls. Well, it could be that the children are preserving original thought processes that we lose as we mature and grow old. Which, by the way, that's another widespread belief, that as we age, we become corrupt, that we begin with magical contact, we have imaginary companions, we perhaps have memories of previous lives, but then as we age, we become corrupt, and all these, we become cynical, we doubt, and we lose this power that children naturally have. But it is interesting how the universal laws of magic are just everywhere.
And, well, do you know, Dr. Mirabella, one of the things I always found fascinating, and I've heard in a few different machinations, but I wasn't sure if this was would lend itself into this type of lore, that even the story of the Tooth Fairy was basically founded in kind of what you've been discussing. The reason that the Tooth Fairy came about was parents wanted to control the teeth. They didn't want the teeth falling into the hands of strangers, neighbors, the local witches, whatever, because if they could get that, especially the first tooth or the first clippings of hair, that would be considered a very powerful amulet that they could use to possibly control you later. So the idea was there was a trade, you know, for a treat, for money, whatever it was, the tooth would be left and something would be left in its place. Then the parents would be tasked with crushing or burning the tooth, getting rid of that so that there could be no magical harm done.
Exactly. That's true. And it reminds me, too, is in West African cultures, they believe that the afterbirth is actually everyone's twin. Everyone comes in the world with a twin. And that's why the afterbirth is treated with great reverence and has to be taken care of in a certain way, because, again, it's connected to you forever.
Huh.
And the separation cannot be broken. That's why I mentioned earlier a lot of these sort of New Age texts tend to be corrupting some of this stuff. You have to be really careful, for example, of let's say you have something from a child in magical thinking, and then you burn it because or destroy it. That's actually going to hurt the child because the connection remains. I remember one, I don't know why it pops in my mind, there was this sort of New Age bookstore that had this sort of paperback book on how to become wealthy, and then it was for basically quasi-witches, and it said, take this green candle and burn it, and it'll bring you money. Well, again, anyone who knows basic magic, that's not how it works. When you burn something, you're going to send it away. There are ways to create magical prosperity, but that's not the way it's done. Oh, and by the way, I should mention, because I keep referring to voodoo, I remember mentioning this on a different podcast, but always intrigued me. A lot of Americans don't realize that as a young couple on their honeymoon, Bill and Hillary Clinton went on their honeymoon to Port-au-Prince and actually were part of a voodoo ceremony. Now, oddly enough, you can find evidence of this in the New York Times because the voodoo priest passed away in the past year, and in his obituary in the New York Times, it mentions this. And anyone,
are you sure this wasn't reported in the National Enquirer or the Weekly World News?
No. Type in New York Times and type in the Clintons, and you'll get an obituary of this voodoo priest who died in the past year. I was stunned. I knew that this operation had occurred, but I was stunned that the New York Times covered it.
Wow.
Of course, the way they did it was typical New York Times fashion. Isn't this great? The Clintons are multicultural, and they were going to Port-au-Prince. And they depicted it in such a way that they were simply, some harmless little ceremony to basically strengthen their love, perhaps. anyone in Port-au-Prince would almost certainly be convinced that's how he became the President of the United States, and that's how she went so far in life. In voodoo, it's always believed that anyone who's really powerful, really important, and they would include Trump in this as well, has to do some kind of deal with powerful forces. And by the way, the payment is also very powerful, or I should say high. So if they had any kind of knowledge of what they were doing, almost certainly they were a young couple thinking, well, gee, this would be great if this worked.
Right.
Perhaps it'll bring us money and power. But, excuse me, of course, I'm talking about magic. I should use one to cure the cough.
Right.
it was quite stunning that they would do this. And incidentally, in voodoo, they would believe, for example, a pope is a great magician as well. You don't just become pope. You don't become Pope Francis by being a nice man in Argentina. They always assume that anyone who achieves heights of power and fame has done something somehow.
I know there's a lot of articles online, and again, I'm very skeptical of, as I'm sure you are, everything that's online is not always true, but there has been a lot said regarding dark ceremonies that have always taken place at the Vatican and are a part of their history. And, you know, what exactly is that power that they're dealing with, and what were these dark ceremonies for? Some call them satanic rituals and say they've always been a part of the Vatican and the Catholic religion. Others say that this was ways to beg off and hold back the darkness. So it's fascinating to me, and we're going to keep talking about this. We've got so much more to discuss this evening on the show, and Dr. Mirabella will be our guest for the remainder of the night. We'll be back. We've got so much more to cover here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader, your host this evening. And Tim, again, will be back with us next week, kids, so bear with us. We've got 1 week off from Timmy D as he's recuperating from his foot surgery. Maybe I'll get the good doctor here to give me a good spell that we can use to help get Tim healthy and back on his feet, or maybe just teach him to eat the right way. Either way, it might be helpful for him, but our thoughts and prayers are out with him right now as he is recovering from foot surgery and is on the mend in what we are calling the rebuilding Timmy year. We are going through a lot of medical issues and maladies to get him fully back on his feet, and he should be by the end of 2017. I think we're slowly replacing him part by part. We can rebuild him. We have the technology. He will be the bionic co-host, and he'll be back with Beyond the Darkness. Our guest this evening, Dr. Mark Mirabello. We're discussing forbidden knowledge of the supernatural, sorcery, forbidden lore, and more. Fascinating stuff we're talking about, and I love this because, you know, magic has always been such an important part of my world. I mean, first of all, I grew up loving magicians, Doug Henning, David Copperfield, Harry Houdini, anything I could read on this Blackstone, and wanted to know more about these guys and kind of the legend that surrounds them, because even though they were illusionists, there was this magical vibe around them that there was something more than just sleight of hand and smoke and mirrors. There were people that believed that the supernatural was involved in what they were doing. And it's not so far removed, folks. As we were talking to Dr. Mark Mirabello, when we talked in the first segment, Doctor, we were talking about how magic works. And you're changing one thing into another, or you're evolving one thing to something else. And that's kind of what science, well, not kind of, that's exactly what science is, right? It's taking different principles, eye of newt and wing of bat and, you know, tears of a baby, and mixing them all together. And we've got Imodium AD to stop you up from diarrhea, right? I mean, that's essentially what magic is.
Yes, and by the way, one point I should throw in about magic that I didn't really mention in the first half. We use the term, it comes from the Pacific Islands, but it's, again, a universal concept. It's the idea of mana, and it's often been described as an impersonal supernatural force that's what typically the magician is tapping into. And mana, for example, why would some arrows fly truer than others? Why are some knives better than others? And this is, again, an impersonal supernatural force that the craftsman, or for that matter, magician, will tap into. And the parallels between magic and science, you're correct, they're very similar, which is curious because scientific thinkers often view them as very different. And, of course, there's that famous Arthur C. Clarke line. He was the scientist slash sci-fi writer who said that at a certain advanced state, magic becomes, science becomes indistinguishable from magic. But it's, again, all about power. We forget that's what science is about, technology and magical operations. And incidentally, I should also throw in, it occurred to me during the break, that we were talking about, again, the voodoo and the Clintons and so forth. A rather curious event occurred when Pope John Paul II visited Haiti in the 1980s. And it's hard to believe that this was done accidentally, but of course that would be the Vatican's opinion. If you remember when he was Pope, he always had this rather curious custom. He would arrive in a country, descend open stairwell from the plane, go on his knees and kiss the ground when he first arrived, which is really curious because that's a pagan ritual. You talked about how often the Vatican seems a bit unusual, and that would be worshiping Mother Earth, which in most pagan religions is a goddess. Well, when he arrived in Port-au-Prince, or I should say Haiti the first time, all these people were there cheering, welcoming the Pope, because he's, again, a powerful figure. And he came down the stairwell, and he went to his knees, kissed the earth in Haiti, but oddly enough, he kissed it twice, which in a magical operation is a curse. And he freaked out the Haitians.
Wow.
And in fact, many of them to this day say they date all of their recent problems from that visit, that the great Boko sorcerer, John Paul II, cursed them when he arrived. Now, again, Westerners would simply say, oh, that's not really what happened, and so on and so forth. But sometimes they do some curious things. And again, the Vatican is so, I'm not trying to demonize it or say it's
No, Vatican, I understand.
But it's so old and has so many traditions and so many secrets. And remember, ultimately, secrecy is power. I think there's a bit more to it that often these recent popes are just basically rock star figures that glad hand everybody and bless everybody. But 19th century Protestants in particular used to attack the papacy as a really dangerous institution. And they were kind of familiar with things that people no longer talk about. In the 19th century, when they claimed the chair of St. Peter, the legendary chair of St. Peter was supposed to be from the first Pope, St. Peter himself, they found the signs of the zodiac and the labors of Hercules on it. Now, what's that doing there? So, again, there's all these rather curious traditions and so forth about the Vatican and its power. And by the way, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there was a medieval Irish theologian who made these prophecies about future popes, and he predicted we're in the last pope now.
Right.
And that Rome will be destroyed after this. Does that mean the earth is destroyed, the city of Rome, or the Vatican? All of these rather curious traditions. And I should also mention, because we're talking about, again, on this Vatican issue, but in Haiti itself, your typical sorcerer will actually be a priest by day. They have no problem crossing over from the God of the Christians and of Moses and of Jesus over to the old gods of Africa at night. So, And I think one of the issues, of course, in monotheism, there's only one God, one path, one truth. But in traditional religions, every source is legitimate, and you should study it and try to use it. So, rich ideas out there.
Wow, fascinating. Again, the whole idea of the Pope and the fact that people of Haiti might look at him as kind of a great sorcerer who brought about a lot of misery, that's something totally new to me. When we look at these different ideas and ideals of the supernatural, and you mentioned earlier about the biblical references, I always thought it was fascinating, right, when there was And again, not trying to debate theology or get people all irritated that we talk about it, but so much of our culture in this world, and especially in the United States, is based on a religious belief system. And it was Christianity for a long period of time. And it's funny how we will draw these dividing lines of what is believable, what is not. But here in the Bible, you've got when Moses was trying to save and free his people, right? There were these plagues that they would call down from the heavens, and Pharaoh would try to see if his sorcerers could do the same thing. And if he could, he said that this is no great God movement. This is something that any magician could pull off. And the sorcerers were able to replicate a lot of what was taking place in these plights and plagues that were taking place. So again, you start looking at the fact that this magical realm has always existed around us. And what we do as ghost hunters and paranormal investigators and UFO hunters and cryptid researchers, in a sense, is just forms of conjuring, isn't it? We go to a place, we sit ritualistically, sometimes in a circle, we call out to the spirits, we ask for them to make their presence known. These seem like the beginnings of invocation of magical practices.
Exactly. In fact, what you're practicing is called necromancy, and it's considered one of the, not that you shouldn't do it, because I know you have background in this, but it's one of the most dangerous of the practices, when you summon the dead from the other side. And incidentally, your comment about, you're exactly right, where the Bible actually admits that the early part of the various plagues that were coming down, the Egyptian priest could match it, even admits that. But what's interesting about especially the Old Testament, as well as the New, but especially the Old, is it's because our education is so compartmentalized now, even a lot of the ministers and theologians don't really realize what they're looking at when they're reading the Old Testament, because everything is, again, as I say, they're not taking, shall we say, courses in anthropology they should be taking, or ancient traditions and religions. Now, this just pops into mind. And by the way, Sir James Frazer, the great religion historian and folklorist in the 19th, early 20th century, he pointed out that rituals outlive beliefs. And that's actually true. We will continue to do things after we've forgotten why we do them. And then what happens is the experts invent a rationalization. Now, classic example pops into my mind of where the pork taboo, which is found not only in Judaism, but also in Islam. And if you were to ask a modern rabbi, why don't they eat pork? He'll give you a rationalization. Well, it was an unclean animal, and there were various infections being passed, which, of course, is just the rationalization. The key point about the pig, now again, is that not only may pious Jews not eat it, they can't kill it. A lot of people don't realize that. And we think it may have once been a sacred animal. And what happened was a strange inversion occurred. Now, in the case of India, they had the sacred animal. It continued as the cow, and they no longer they can. We have evidence in the early Vedas that originally Hindus were allowed to kill the cow under certain circumstances and eat beef, only certain circumstances. But then over time, it became petrified, and now it's absolutely taboo. In the case of Judaism, I'm not trying to call them pig worshippers or something. But there clearly is this element. It was a sacred animal originally and could not therefore be killed. Why would they make it that way? Well, first of all, Bedouins never have access to pigs. They're too intelligent to herd. And as a result, the desert Bedouin, that's not an animal he has contact with, and the ancient Jews are Bedouins, as are the Muslims. Another factor is out in the desert, unlike goats or unlike cows, or camels, the pig eats the same food we do. So if you have a pig out in the desert, he's competing with you with the food sources. And an even more curious idea is that, now again, I've never had this firsthand, but the Polynesian people who were cannibals said they called humans long pig because humans taste like pork, strangely enough. So that may have been the origin of the taboo. Also, when you kill a pig, it sounds like a child screaming. So this may have been their fear of the killing the animal. Now, I should also mention, we have this really bad word we're incorrectly translating. It's throughout the Old Testament Mosaic law. And I should mention that roughly 20% of ancient Hebrew is of an uncertain definition. And you'll see the word unclean. For example, women in menstrual periods, women after birth are unclean. Well, that's almost certainly a mistranslation of what's going on. The reason you're not supposed to touch menstruating women and women soon after birth is they're magically charged. Women are involved in birth. It is the essential female function, and they're dangerous during that period to outsiders. And that's why a lot of cultures practice isolation of women during menstrual period and birth. Now, the Plains Indians did that as well. A hunter who would go off to kill the bison or go on the war path among the Comanche, for example, just before he departed, he had to avoid his wife at all costs, because if she should have the flow of blood through sympathetic magic, they thought he could be injured or killed while on the war path or in the hunt. Now, oddly enough, today there's this debate in the Catholic Church, should women be allowed to be priests? And it's really curious. I don't see a single one of these theologians giving the real reason for why the original taboo was there. Is in the original Christian practice, women were not allowed in churches during menstruation, and clearly not on the altar. And because of the possibility that they could undergo a period of blood during the Mass, they were prohibited from being priests. And it's simple as that. And you get these modern...
You would think that something like that with renewal, right? Women, they say most likely one of the factors to why women outlive men is because of the renewal of blood on a continual basis from early age until, you know, menopausal state, that refreshing of blood is like a recycling. It's almost like rebirthing into Christ. It's, you know, I mean, I would say that would seem like a more powerful magic and would have been, it should have been more embraced. But again, it was a male-dominated period in history, too, wasn't it? So, you know, looking for reasons to maybe separate male from women and why men are stronger and more capable and why they should be the ones in charge might have played a big part of this.
Well, in fact, strangely enough, in traditional cultures, it's not about, and I think that's one of the big issues I have with a lot of modern anthropology. They turn things into feminist or gender issues, which are really not there. They don't understand how magic works. For example, we allow fathers and also male obstetricians in a birth room. That would be totally bizarre, and it would to traditional cultures to have any men present during birth. The midwife was always a post-menstrual woman who had given birth herself, and she was the wise woman who had the experience. And they would, in fact, the first male obstetrician, we can call him that, was at the court of Louis XIV. He had his court physician deliver a child from one of his mistresses. And at the time, it was considered really bizarre behavior. So I think a lot of these issues, we turn them into, and while I'm on this, I should mention, here's a classic example. And I'm not trying to say that they should not stop these campaigns, but modern people, there's that what we consider an infamous practice of female circumcision. And it's been turned into a feminist issue. And they are trying to argue that these are mean men trying to suppress female sexual desire. In the most extreme case of circumcision of women, it involves the removal of the clitoris. Now, this is absolutely ridiculous that it has anything to do with suppressing sexual desire. That may be a side effect, but that's not what's going on. And we know this because in most traditional cultures that understand where conception comes from, and oddly enough, they only understand at a certain level of development, they reason by analogy. This is also magical thinking. Men must experience pleasure to give birth to cause children to be born. They also reason that women must experience pleasure for them to conceive. And the last thing on their minds is to suppress female sexual desire, because they think they're making them infertile if they do that. So where is this peculiar practice? Well, the Dogon people in Mali are almost certainly preserving the original form of circumcision. And now, again, it's in a changed and corrupted form in some of the later traditions, but here it's in the original form. And that, first of all, it's a puberty ritual. It's not done to children. It becomes when you become an adult. and traditional peoples notice that little girls and little boys are virtually indistinguishable. In fact, recently, about a year ago, they were making a big deal. The little girl who won she was the pitcher in the Children's World Series. Do you remember that case?
Right.
Yeah, and this is a ridiculous point to make because when you're before puberty, little girls are often stronger than little boys because they mature faster. So to argue that some little girl was achieving something wonderful at 11 when she was throwing the ball better than the boys is absolutely ridiculous. Now, after puberty kicks in, there's going to be a difference. And if a woman's able to throw a fastball at 18, fast as a male, that's going to be an achievement. Now, back to the original point, they notice that girls and boys are very similar. So at puberty, the boys go through the ritual, and they literally, not to get graphic on your audience, but they believe that the foreskin on the males is actually similar to vaginal lips. And an uncircumcised male has feminine traits. So he will be circumcised at roughly 12 or 13. And oddly enough, the body part is actually eaten. It's not just cast away. He's circumcised, and he shows his manhood by not showing pain. Meanwhile, they believe that the clitoris is actually a male trait. That's why little girls resemble little boys. So at puberty, they remove it to turn her into a pure woman. Now, we would object to this and say it's just cruel and heartless and all the rest, but we have to understand where it's coming from.
Wow.
And originally, that's clearly what they're doing. They're producing pure women in their minds and pure males. It's not about oppression. It's not about gender issues. It's all about magic and magical thinking. Now, again, this is not to excuse it,
right,
but it's clearly we have to understand before we attack things. And there's another point I should mention about, again, this happened a couple of years ago in New York City. In the original, now, Jewish boys, it's really important to be circumcised. And in fact, they believe that if you're not circumcised, they don't have the heaven the Christians do, but they have Gan Eden, which is the Garden of Eden still exists. And they believe the circumcised boy will be recognized by the angels. So if a boy dies as a baby, they actually circumcise the corpse because it's important that he be marked by God or for God. Now, a couple of years ago, every once in a while, the news will get a hold of this. And this is in no way, if you understand where it's coming from. Remember, we talked about the blood taboo.
Right.
And it's throughout Judaism. Ultra-Orthodox Jews, they have a special class of circumcisers called the moils. And this is an ancient practice. Originally, they used flint instruments. Now they're using steel.
Jeez.
And the little boy is circumcised at age 8. You may not allow the blood of the boy to touch the earth. So what the moil would do is after he cut the foreskin, he would put his mouth on the wound. Now, if you understand magic, this has nothing to do with sex or sexual assault on a baby. It's the sacred blood of this Jewish boy may not touch the earth. But a couple of years ago, someone got a hold of this, and they were running stories in the New York Times and all the rest about this was going on. It only happens among the ultra-Orthodox Jews. Most of the Reform, well, all of them, Reform, Conservative, and all that, they're really westernized, so they wouldn't be doing this anymore. But the ultra-Orthodox, they're taking their Judaism really seriously, and they're following the old practices as far as they can. And again, before we start judging that these are weirdos sexually assaulting babies, it's protecting the blood. And incidentally, that's what kosher food practice is all about. It's to get the blood out of the animal, because pious Jews may not eat blood, because the blood is the life, as the Bible says. And a few years ago, Sweden passed a law against animal cruelty, and it ended up outlawing both halal practices of the Muslims and also kosher meat practices of the Jews. Of course, they retracted it after they found out. Because the animal has to be conscious, hanging upside down, and you slit its throat to get as much blood out of it as possible before it can be prepared as meat. Again, it's not designed to be cruel. It's not designed to be odd. It's simply designed to protect, in a magical worldview, the body of the Jewish person or Muslim person eating the meat. Huh. And you'll notice also in the New Testament, Paul will make a reference to Christians eating food offered to idols. He condemns this. Modern readers don't realize what he's referring to is in the ancient world, the Romans and the Greeks, they never just butchered animals. Everything was a sacrifice. So when Christians went to get some meat, the animals had been offered to the gods. And that's what Paul's referring to. We have reduced, in fact, it's rather curious, what traditional peoples turn into religious acts, we turn into profane acts. A sacrifice of an animal, which we think is really bad and weird and strange, we just turn into slaughterhouses. Another oddity is virtually all traditional sacred acts have been turned into vices. Dancing is originally a religious ritual. It's not just for pleasure. Taking hallucinogenic drugs is to see the gods. You consume the flesh of the gods to see the gods. We turn this into drug parties. Gambling techniques, drawing lots, is to determine the will of the gods. We turn this into Vegas. It's one after another. Everything that used to be sacred, we've turned into something profane. And by the way, even the sexual act, which we view as either for pleasure or procreation, in traditional cultures, the woman's body is an altar, and the sex act is a religious act. That's why the Kama Sutra in India, it's not a sex manual. It's produced by the religion. I mean, it ends up being used as a sex manual, but they understand that all of this is sacred power.
Well, that makes sense, because during sex, if you're doing it right, there should be a lot of calling upon God. When you're doing all this research and you're looking into these weird, and again, maybe weird is not the right term, but weird to us in this new 21st century realm, the ideas of these magical practices and why these things occurred, why they happened. You've brought up vampires and some of these other creatures, throughout and, you know, bodily fluids, seminal fluids, blood, and other things have long since considered to have kind of powers. And I know that even hunters, traditional hunters, still will drink the blood of their first kill of the season to empower themselves and pay honor to the animal that they killed. Some believe that also gives them abilities of some of these animals. And that starts to, you know, bring to mind thoughts of like werewolves and lycanthropes. What can you tell us regarding that? I mean, is there any kind of real history to the idea of human form changing into animal and back again? Is there any real magical practice for this that's been seen and talked about?
Yes, and by the way, that's one of the oldest traditions, and it's not just the wolf. It's always based on the most violent predator in the area. You have the leopard men of West Africa. You have the wolf men in Europe. You have the jaguar men in South America. So it's a widespread notion.
And don't forget, now, you have the three-toed sloth man of Minnesota. That's me. Slow moving.
By the way, when you mentioned, before I mentioned, got into this, I should also remind me what you said about modern hunting practices, because the Twa people of the Congo, and they're, contrary to popular belief, almost all Africans are farmers historically. They're not hunters and gatherers. They're farmers or animal herders, and there are very few hunters and gatherers. And the Twa, better known as the pygmy, but that's the politically incorrect term for them, they have this really interesting ritual still practiced. They will draw, and this has all of the notions of magic to it, they will draw the image of the antelope they're going to hunt on the ground, so that it's, and when it's touched by the first rays of the sun. And they then believe that that'll make them, and then they, after the rays of the sun touch it, they draw it, wait for the first dawn to touch it, and then they will shoot an arrow into the image. And then they believe by acting out, this is again imitative magic, by acting out the original, they make the real thing, or I should say acting it out, they make the real thing occur.
Creative visualization.
After they have a successful hunt, they go back and they take some hair and perhaps meat from the animal they have slain, and they reverse everything. They erase the image when the sun touches the image. Now, what they're doing is the first act is to make the hunt successful. The second act is out of respect for the slain animal who's given its meat to the hunters, is they're allowing it to come back, to be reborn again. hence they reverse the ritual. This is a common notion among hunters. They will not only kill something, they will make it an act of worship, and then they will do something to let the animal come back. Eskimos used to preserve the bones intact of the slain sea mammals they were killing, thinking that the animal returned. Now, having got off on that tangent, I forgot where I was going.
No problem. Yeah, we're getting close to showtime. Yeah, werewolves. Let's talk about the ideas of werewolves and zombies and some of these other horrifying creatures that, you know, are part of our nightmares and horror movie genres.
Well, what happens is the horror films and pop writers, they, again, corrupt the original belief. For example, most notably would be the silver bullet. That's not found anywhere.
Uh-huh.
You kill a werewolf with silver bullet. That's from the Universal Pictures version in the 1940s, the first time you see that. But the animal, the idea of a connection, and we have Greek writers talking about, and by the way, one historical figure won an Olympic event, and the Greeks said, I forget his name, the reason he won is he had been a werewolf for several years, and that's what made him so tough and fast. And it was practiced in Arcadia. This is an especially wild area of Greece. And there were shepherds there, and the shepherds are always enemies of the wolf, which preys upon their sheep and their flocks. And they had a ritual they practiced in which apparently they killed a child. And they cooked the child with some other meat, food, in a cauldron, and they put a little piece of the child in the cauldron. And this is from Greek accounts. It's not some modern rationalization. And then the man who ate, among the shepherds, who ate the human flesh, got what was called the wolf madness. And he would strip off his clothes, and he would run on all fours, and he would howl like a wolf for, in most accounts, it's 9 years. And if he could avoid killing a human during those 9 years, the wolf madness would later dissipate. He would remember who he was. If he did kill a human during that time, he spent the rest of his life as a wolf. Now, he doesn't really apparently change shape. He acts like a wolf. And normally when we find these things, there's also the famous leopard men of West Africa. They were observed by the British in the 19th century. And incidentally, I mentioned earlier that there's these special female religious cults that go on, such as around birth. These cults are always male only. Our idea that everything has to be post-gender and all this is kind of ridiculous in a magical context, because they believe that males and females have different magical powers and must be kept separate. Well, the leopard men of West Africa, it was handed down from father to son, and apparently uncle to nephew, if there were no son. And to get into the secret society of the leopard men, and there are books on this written in the 19th century by the British, you apparently had to offer a female relative, especially a daughter or a niece, as a sacrifice victim, in which she would be hunted and killed and eaten by the other members of the leopard men society. And they would dress in leopard's loincloths and carry iron claws. They would kill the victim with these claws. Now, why are they doing this? It's, again, about magical power. In South America, they believe the jaguar men, in fact, some of the cultures believe there is no such thing as an animal called the jaguar. It's actually the shaman. These are these powerful magical figures. Now, in that case, the shaman actually is becoming the animal. He changes shape, as we do in the Hollywood films, where he becomes the wolf. So we have some of these legends where the human becomes the animal. Now, often in those cases, in fact, there's a reference to Odin, the pagan god, being able to do this in various Norse accounts. The original goes into a sleep, a deep sleep, and then he manifests as the animal outside of his body and hunts. And then if you wound the animal, you will actually wound the original body that's back home resting. So this connection between wild animals, and it's really interesting, it's always the focus is always on a violent animal. Humans are not interested in kind of lazy, stupid, weak animals. It's always the violent, strong ones. And there has to be a reason for that, which, by the way, predators are never sacrificed. They sacrifice cows, they sacrifice goats, but they never sacrifice crocodiles, lions, and tigers. There has to be a reason for that. Probably the awe that these animals evoke in humans. And certainly if you saw a jaguar or a tiger or a wolf in the wild, it's a pretty awesome sight. So I can see where the connection comes from.
So we just sacrifice the fat and lazy is what you're saying. So in the animal world, I'm one that's going to be the first on the sacrificial slab. So the idea that werewolves, that these creatures existed or continue to exist, I mean, we hear claims of these dogmen around the United States, Dr. Mirabello. And, you know, there are it's not just some backcountry drunk guy that saw these things. There are people from all walks of life and belief systems and race and religions that are witnessing these large dogmen. What do you make of accounts like that?
Well, you know, to tell the truth, the dog, he's such an admired beast in pop American culture. I could see where this is coming from, but in most traditional cultures, the dog is actually considered a vile animal. He's a slave. As Nietzsche said, we've turned the wolf into a dog, and he meant that in a negative way. So it sounds as if almost it's a corrupted version of the werewolf legend, because the dog is literally considered a low animal in most of these traditions. I can't recall a single case among traditional cultures where the dog becomes the center of these cults. Now, keep in mind, as I mentioned ad nauseum probably tonight, modern culture often gives corrupted versions of these original stories. So that's where that could be coming from. It becomes from the wolf, it becomes the dog. I should mention, there was Seabrook, I think was his name, was a British writer. A lot of people accuse him of making things up because he also talked about lurid tales of cannibalism in the Pacific and also voodoo sacrifices in Haiti. But he describes in 1930s, he claims he witnessed it, a werewolf cult in London, in which to become werewolves, they would commit essentially several abominations. It included drinking rainwater from the footprint of a wolf, eating raw brains from a freshly killed wolf, drinking blood from the brain of an insane person, and wearing a leather shirt made from the skin of a hanged man. And they thought they could become the wolves. Now, notice the reference to the blood of an insane person for the brain. Again, a modern person would rationalize this and say it's rabies. Now, here's another example, though, how rabies is really curious, and almost certainly that's where we just dismiss it. We often think if we can describe it, we understand it. But these animals, and of course that's the Cujo novel by Stephen King in the film is based on the rabid dog, how these animals that are rabid and humans that are rabid, they behave so bizarrely. But why are they afraid of water, which is really curious, when they're rabid? But again, it could be some kind of peculiar, what the traditional peoples would say, a magical sickness, which makes these werewolves and so forth, as opposed to we just dismiss it as a medical condition, which, oddly enough, we do the same thing with lycanthropy. There are people in mental hospitals today that think they're wolves. And the psychologists just say, tut, tut, this is all in your head. But perhaps there's more to it.
Do you have any insight? And I know time's running out on us here. One of the other things that, you know, let's face it, the last 10 years and since Night of the Living Dead, that's really kind of captured our attention, and now even more so in pop culture, is the Living Dead, the zombie effect. And is there any stories to this? And I know we talked earlier about Haiti and Port-au-Prince and many of these stories. What do we know about the magic of zombies, and did that ever occur? Is that still occurring?
Yeah, you could probably go right now to fly to Haiti and find a zombie somewhere. They're universally believed in, although once again our pop culture has completely altered what they really are. And in fact, that's probably of all these legends we've discussed today, that's probably the one, or tonight, that's the one that's been most distorted. There's nothing about, they don't eat brains, for example, and Haitians don't fear zombies at all, which is really curious. because they're really easy to defeat. They walk around dragging their feet. They have glassy eyes. They speak in a nasalized tone. What the Haitians are afraid of are being turned into zombies. And what a zombie actually is a slave, period. He's and the stories are that these Boko sorcerers will make them for manual labor or crime. And, of course, one particular fearsome aspect, women in Haiti, we have these issues in our culture with sexual harassment and all this sort of thing. Well, a woman in Haiti would be really afraid of rejecting the advances of a Boko sorcerer because he could turn her into a zombie, and she would obey him and do everything he wants. She would lose her mind. And what a zombie really is in their tradition is they, like many cultures, there are two souls. There's a life soul and there's the mind soul. And what the sorcerer does, according to the tradition, he captures the mind soul and he keeps it prisoner in a glass bottle, in prison in a glass bottle. And then the body still has the life soul, but not the mind, and must obey the sorcerer. And the way they do this, there are several ways to do it. In fact, oddly enough, the most common one is called the zombie powder, which is actually illegal in Haitian law. There's a law against it from the 19th century. So seriously, I mean, it's clearly taken seriously. And some years ago, Wade Davis wrote The Serpent and the Rainbow. He was the graduate student from an Ivy League college and announced he had solved the mystery of the zombie. This was, again, Western conceit again. He discovered that they were using pufferfish. Well, we've known that for a couple centuries, that the pufferfish venom, among other things, is used in the zombie powder, if you will. And now, again, we view it, if we can observe the substance, we think we understand what's going on. And according to Wade Davis, the zombie powder was blown into the face of the victim. It caused brain damage, and then the sorcerer went to the cemetery at night, used a second powder that restored some of the consciousness as an antidote, but not all of it, and he thought he had explained the mystery of the zombies. Well, that's not what was going on, at least according to the Haitians. And the zombie powder has many ingredients in addition to the puffer venom, and it can be rubbed on the skin or blown into the face if, again, you're walking down the street and someone emerges from the shadows and blows dust in your face, be really alarmed, because that's what that probably is. And the story is you then basically slowly get paralyzed. You become paralyzed, and you slowly sink into a catatonic state, and then you're essentially dead. Now, again, rationalists would say that the person is catatonic. He's still alert, but he's actually can't move.
Right.
And then the sorcerer goes to the cemetery at night. Always it involved bribing the funeral director to get access to the corpse. He goes at night, blows a second powder into the face. He also calls out the name of the victim, and then when the person emerges from the grave, he whips him. That's the first thing he does, and he treats him again as a slave. Now, the zombie must never eat salt, because as soon as he eats just one particle of salt, he realizes what has happened to him, and he will go off and kill the sorcerer, and then tried to bury himself in his own grave with his bare hands, according to tradition. So again, if you're attacked by a zombie, you just give it salt, no problem. So what they're afraid of is being turned into these things.
That damn salt's going to get you in life with high blood pressure and in the afterlife as a zombie killer, huh?
Well, you know what's really curious is with the reference to salt, that's actually a supernatural substance in virtually all cultures. And it's kind of curious that we demonize it. They try to have people restricting salt intake and so forth. And if you get into these really strange conspiracy theories, they're often saying that what the authorities are telling us is intentionally false. You know, that salt is necessary. If you don't have any salt in your diet, you die, which is curious. So you have these people, and of course it's almost impossible to avoid salt totally. That's why people aren't dying. But these people getting obsessive with controlling salt in their diets, well, you could argue maybe they're trying to zombify the entire American population. That's why they're telling us not to eat the salt.
I think the Kardashians are doing that to us. It has nothing to do with salt.
That could very well be. But it symbolizes immortality and life, because salt preserves things and is Which reminds me that there's that famous reference to salt by Jesus of Nazareth, which almost all modern people misunderstand. He says, "You are the salt of the earth, and if salt loses its taste, it's cast underfoot and trampled." And everybody misses the point today. But if you're magical thinking, you don't. Salt never loses its taste. He's probably trying to say that we are always of value. But modern people misread even some really clear statements because we're becoming so detached from real life nowadays. Everything is packaged, processed, and delivered to us. So we miss really obvious references.
Let me ask you one more thing before we have to wrap up the evening. One thing that's, again, always been a point of intrigue for me and probably a lot of our listeners is the idea of invisibility. Whether it's ghosts or aliens or even the ability of Bigfoot to cloak itself, has there ever been any historical reference to the idea of truly being able to become invisible? Are there spells that are known to work? And if so, how do I do it? And I need it in time to get into the Vikings cheerleaders dressing room this year.
Well, oddly enough, that's viewed as a really minor operation in Tibetan Buddhism, strangely enough. And it's believed that as, now if this sounds, if you haven't, similar to, it almost sounds like I'm overlapping with Scientology here, but clearly L. Ron Hubbard was familiar with Eastern religions when he was composing Scientology texts. As a side effect of gaining spiritual mastery, they don't use the word spiritual there, but basically self-discipline, you develop various arcane powers, including becoming invisible. And most yoga, which again, Americans use it as to lose weight or to sleep better, which is ridiculous. It's a sacred process. It's all about self-discipline. And one of the most difficult things to do is to control your mind and your thoughts. And it's believed in Tibetan Buddhism, if you can stop all thought, you will become invisible completely. You'll disappear. And only these advanced yogic practitioners can do it. Now, in the West, we have a more sinister ceremony called the Hand of Glory. I actually saw one in a British museum. It was actually quite, shall we say, creepy. It was used as late as the 18th century by criminals. And it was believed if they had one of these, they could rob the house. Now, there were various versions of how this worked. Some said that the family would not awaken if you had the Hand of Glory while you entered the house. But in the more traditional, earlier versions, is it made the criminal invisible. And what it was, he had a candle literally made out of fetus fat of a slain, aborted baby. And it was put into the mummified, dried hand of an executed felon, and it was believed that when you lit the candle and it burned, you would be invisible. Now, in some versions, the light would be invisible, that's why they couldn't see you, but in other versions, you become invisible. So this notion you could disappear is found in many traditions, and oddly enough, is viewed as a relatively easy thing to do in many of these cultural practices.
The Hand of Glory, not to be confused with the Hole of Glory, Doc. Don't fall for that one. We've had a great time. I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening and sharing some insights, and I'd love to get you back. Maybe around the next Friday the 13th, we can have you back, and we'll talk about superstitions and some more of this forbidden knowledge that that I think is fascinating. Would you come back with us again here, Doctor?
Well, yes. Thank you again. I'm always honored to be on your show. It's an excellent show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm not just saying that about when I'm on it. It's an excellent show overall.
I'll take it either way. I don't mind. Audrey Starborn Hewins is our guest tomorrow. Audrey is an identical twin born in 1973. And after a lifelong alien abductee experiencer, she is finally going to come forward, talk to us about her story, her cases, and her experiences. We'll do that tomorrow on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Very special thanks to our guests this evening, Dr. Mark Mirabello. And don't forget, I'll be hosting Coast to Coast AM, so you get me 6 nights this week. You get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, right here on Beyond the Darkness. And then go check out coasttocoastam.com. /stations. You'll find stations in the areas that you live so that you can listen to the show, stream it live, or you can check us out at KNSI, the radio station in St. Cloud, Minnesota. You can stream it right from their website as well and keep in touch with it. And make sure you check out who George has got going on this week as well. He's always got fascinating guests. And if you like what you hear here on Beyond the Darkness, you're going to love what George Norrie has for you over on Coast to Coast AM. That's it for this evening. We'll be back tomorrow with more Beyond the Darkness.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabay Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slipcovers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out WashableSofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabay sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.